DW Africa Link.
Ghana is rich in gold, but the West African country still loses billions of dollars every year from illegal gold mining and smuggling. From environmental destruction in communities to extremist groups funding violence through illegal mining, the region faces a complex crisis. So what's the real price of Africa's gold rush, and who's paying for it? Is Ghana's gold rush making the country richer or leaving it with lasting scars? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and you are welcome to Africa Link, the podcast connecting you to the stories that matter.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
Ghana's gold glitters on the global market, but behind that shine lies a murky underworld. The country is Africa's top gold producer, overtaking South Africa in recent years. Yet, billions of dollars vanish through illegal mining, known locally as galamsey. Gold brings money and opportunity to some communities, but illegal mining also brings risk, loss, and damage that's hard to undo. According to some estimates, close to 2 million Ghanaians, including many children, are involved in these mines. For some families, the gold trade means survival. For many, it's come at a steep price. Let's get some insights from Solomon Kusiampofo. He's a natural resources governance expert with knowledge in small-scale mining. Maxwell Souk is also with us. He is DW's correspondent in Tamale, northern Ghana. Hello, welcome to Africa Link. Maxwell, you've been covering mining communities for years. What's the reality on the ground in areas affected by illegal gold trade?
Thank you, Eddie, and our listeners. In the north, for instance, the trade, especially the mining activities that is going on, Kalenzi area of the Upper East region, in Upper West, there are some, also the areas of Boku West districts. This is extensively ongoing. The youth takes this as a new job, and even women and children, school children as low as GSS people are all part of this trade. They have to dig to get small amounts, sell and pay school fees. Young people who do not have jobs to do are relying on this. They dig even in front of their homes, by farmlands and the forest reserve close to water bodies. And it is actually like the largest kind of informal employer in this area. Young people, they do not have skills. They do it and feel that it is their right to do it. They used to buy motorbike, to buy also vehicles, build homes. If you go to the Talensi area, for instance, you see young people as young as 18 years having houses and then buying new motorbikes and riding on the road as if they have made it. The other part of it is that these are people who sell to any other person who comes to buy. So as whether they are selling to legitimate dealers or smugglers, that they don't what they care about is just the money. Environmental wise, it's not really good, because I have been to their communities. I see how they even endangered their own ecosystem in front of their homes. Children are falling in the pits. Most of them are left. They are not, covered.
Solomon, let me get to you, because it's interesting what Maxwell is saying. Basically, talking about a whole community that is highly dependent on illegal mining of gold. I'm just wondering now, what's the incentive for them to stop it?
Yeah, so mining, as we know, especially for the artisanal and small scale, provide a lot of livelihoods for young people. They generate a lot of income from the activity to feed themselves and also to feed their families. Since it provides a lot of livelihood, it is quite difficult to take these young people from this activity unless we do a comprehensive review to be able to set up the mining operations in a way that addresses the environmental impacts whilst maximizing the positive impact in terms of providing livelihoods and jobs for these young people.
the challenge is illegal mining here, right? People, as long as people know where the gold is and how to get it, they will find ways to do it. But the problem is people don't want to go through the formal structure. They want to do it illegally.
Yes. So people are doing it illegally because our land tenure system also provides the way for people to do it illegally. So in Ghana, you cannot do mining without the consent of people who have interest in the land. So let me break it down. For example, in northern Ghana, you can't go up, pick your tools to go and start mining when you have not sought the consent of the landowners and people who are occupying the land or people who have interest in that land. And so far as people can agree to give out the land to do mining without you getting the license, that becomes a problem. So for us to be able to address that problem, we need to engage landowners. We need to let them understand that you have the interest in that land, but the use for which the land is supposed to be done, you don't have that authority. And that the minerals within the land also is for the people of Ghana, but it's invested in the president. So you need to go through a legal means of acquiring a license for you to be able to start your mine activity. And if you're able to do that, we can be able to address some of these illegal operations. And that even if we find people undertaking illegal operations, one of the key things we need to do is that we need to go to the bottom and see that who gave out the consent for the land to be used. And if you're able to address and prosecute people who give out land freely or willingly for people to engage in illegal operations, we can be able to address the problem.
Okay. I'm just thinking now, we talk about Ghana, a country that literally used to be called Gold Coast. There's so much gold in the country. Correct me if I'm wrong, but currently Ghana is the largest producer of gold in Africa, right? And one of the largest in the world. So the country is making pretty good money from gold. But I'm just wondering, with illegal mining, which is called galamsey in Ghana, the fact that it's widespread, isn't that impacting the formal mining sector and the national revenue generated from it?
Yes, so it is affecting legal mining operations. It's also affecting government's revenue, and it's also affecting the environment.
Right. I totally agree with you, Solomon, because I feel like we've been talking about this for decades. But let me come to you, Maxwell, now. With your interaction with local residents and illegal miners, how are they responding to government crackdowns or the environmental damage that it's causing them?
Good. So, thank you. On the crackdown, they find that to be an unfair thing. It's like as if the government is taking sides to already add more stones to a mountain. By this, I mean that support established firms, multinationals, and against them. But then they will also feel that the process of acquiring documentation or license to mine is not their problem because it drags a lot. There's a lot of bottlenecks. There's a lot of bureaucracy, and it takes a long time for them. Sometimes you can take up more than 2 years to be able to pursue them. And these are people who do not have patience for that. So they feel that this crackdown seems to be like they are empowering the firms against them. For the aspect of the environmental degradation, though they know that it destroys the environment, but they feel that there is no existence. There is no any firm that do not contribute to environmental destructions. A lot of the mining, especially done by these illegal miners, is on the surface mining. So surface mining, they can reclaim the land. They can cover the piece back. The lands they are mining are in are largely farmlands. So the same lands that they are farming in, they can still go there to mine. So when they do, they cover back the soil and then they can farm in the next rainy season. Then dry season, they can do that. Of course, it's not every community that does that. Some have the open pits that causes challenges that leads to animals drowning and then dying, children falling there and then also dying. but then they want the government to take up, you know, sensitization in a way that it introduces most communities to understand and appreciate that, okay, when you mine, you can cover the piece back, and then you are able to, you know, reclaim the land back. There are actually some challenges also. They are crying of human rights violations. Human rights violations in the sense that there are multinationals that are coming up, Chinese miners most of the time. And if you look at the Minerals Commission report in 2019 against some of the Chinese firms in the Upper East region, like, there have been serious violations, including deaths, including disabilities from these mines.
Are these multinationals or internationals mining legally, or what are we saying?
Yeah, so they mine legally, but you see, this is the entire land that they are supposed to all be sharing. They are all sharing. So they have concessions also where these people claim they originally had license, and the license expired. Renewal has become a problem. They won't get the Mineral Commission to renew their license for them to engage in legal mining. So those multinationals have come to claim those concessions now, pushing the locals out of business, and now they are now virtually becoming illegal miners.
Still doing it legally creates the challenge where it's still affecting the local miners, basically. So the fact that they are doing it legally somehow doesn't excuse the fact that it's still challenging environmentally
to
the locals.
They have these concerns.
Let me get back to you, Solomon, because here's the challenge we're talking about illegal mining, especially. It's just so many different aspects of that. Some experts have also looked at how the illegal mining system infrastructure is somehow encouraging armed conflicts. In the Sahel, for instance, proceeds from the illegal mining is helping to fund such armed conflicts. Is there really the link?
Yeah, so there are evidence to suggest that some proceeds from unlicensed and legal mining operations are also fueling armed conflict in parts of West Africa, and that is a worry for concern. And that is why we need to crack down illegal mining operations by going to the bottom of it.
How does it work? How does illegal mining end up funding armed groups in parts of West Africa and the Sahel?
You know, if you look at the architecture critically, if you count about legal operations, or let's say illegal operations. So someone goes to the ground to talk to a landowner or people who have interest in that land. Then they give their consent for them to use the land for mining. Then the people go and look for financiers. So there are people who are in the periphery or who are sitting somewhere and who are financing these mining operations. So whilst they pump money to acquire equipment, whilst they pump money to acquire the machinery, then whilst the operations are done, then they buy the gold from these miners and also give a share of the proceeds to these miners for the labor that they have done. Then they use these monies to fund or procure guns and machinery to be able to foster conflicts in these areas. So you realize that the people who are financing these illegal mining operations use those proceeds to be able to fund the conflicts that they are leading in these areas. And as I distinguish, probably the people who are the financiers are not directly involved in terms of going to see the landowners or people who have interest in land, but they are somewhere at the background, but they are pumping in a lot of money for people to front to go and acquire the concessions, and they oil the machines that will be used for mining, and they use the process to fund the armed conflicts in these areas. So that's how the architecture works, and that is why we need to crack down not only even the people give the consent, but also try to trace people who are the financiers for these illegal operations.
Right. Thanks for that, Solomon. It's just difficult to understand what or which solution works better, right? Because again, the government has claimed many times that they are clamping down on illegal mining. to prevent all of these things that we're talking about, right? Including the possibility of arming groups that are causing terror to locals in parts of Africa, right? So I just really want to find out, are current government responses like the raids or bans, are they effective, or are they actually in some ways pushing miners further underground?
The government's way of addressing or cracking down the illegal mining operations, for me, is not sustainable, and it can't really address the problem. Let me give you a simple way of how, because the area, the operations are quite complex. So first, you need to even define what is an illegal operations. So an illegal operation, from a simple definition, is that people who are mining without the adequate complements of all licenses. And in Ghana, before you start mining, you need to acquire your mining license, mostly mining license, issued by the minister responsible for lands and natural resources. You need to get your environmental permit issued by the Environmental Protection Authority. You need to get your water use permit issued by the Water Resources Commission of Ghana. Then you also need to get your operating or digging license issued by the Inspectorate Division of the Minerals Commission. So at least you need to get 4 licenses and permits for you to start your mining operation. Each of these permits has its own conditions. If you go
right, Solomon. So the thing is, I think it's very important the point you're making. The point though is, whatever the steps are, people are not doing it and they're engaging in it illegally, and we are seeing the adverse effects. Government says they are clamping down, they are finding ways to do that, but those ways are not working. So what should be the right way to clamp down on illegal miners?
So first of all, we need to categorize the different type of illegal operations. Now, for one of the major ones that are really disturbing us is mining on river bodies, which is illegal because there is no license for mining in river bodies in Ghana and in Ghana. So the first way to tackle it is that you use the state power by setting up a special unit within the Ghana Navy to wipe out all those mining on river bodies and set up a permanent unit for these Navy guards to patrol the water bodies 24/7. And that is a way that you can address one leg of the problem, which is mining on river bodies. The other way is that when you come on land, then there are several reports and from the Minerals Commission that indicate where all illegal operations are. So you also tackle the people who are mining illegally without license. Then you use the Ghana Armed Force and the security operators to tackle these people. Then you set up a permanent military force within these zones to be able to patrol these areas. Then you come there, okay. You have license but are not mining responsibly. Then you revoke their licenses till they start doing the right thing. Then you can install or restore their licenses. And if you adopt this approach, we could be able to address that. Then we also need to address the licensing bit of it, which is that you cannot give out a license to a miner when there is no proof of geological investigations, there is no proof of economic viability of the area, and there is no proof of the finances to be able to set up and build the mine. If we are not able to address this problem, we can't address the illegal mining issues. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much, Solomon. It's just frustrating on the one hand that these steps seem like very basic, straightforward steps to take. Surely the government must know these steps will be more effective. So why are they not doing it? Why is it still seeming so difficult to stop illegal mining?
So there are a number of factors. For me, I think the government lacks the complete understanding of the complexity of the issues and how it could be addressed. They are more looking more into the political angle, engaging in blaming previous governments for that. So all the governments that has been in existence since our fourth republic has been shifting blades. It's because they also lack the understanding of how the problem is and how to address it. So, for example, all the actions that this current government is undertaking had already been taken in the past.
Basically, what you've said is that you feel that the government doesn't fully understand the situation, and this for me sounds very strange. We've had so many different governments and still the situation remains. So all these governments coming up somehow just don't know the right ways to deal with it. It's sounding more of a bigger issue than I even thought, right? But still very interesting points that you're making. Maxwell, as we're trying to wrap this up, I'm wondering, you know, aside the very professional angle that Solomon has given as to the ways that he believes is the right way to tackle illegal mining, do you get a sense, Maxwell, that there are also community-led efforts to tackle this problem and you know, formalize small-scale mining to make sure that everything that is done the right way and the legal way?
Absolutely. So in this whole thing, there are community leaders and the youth that are working together to understand that what their activities are endangering. There are also communities that are complicit in this whole deal, because you find leaders siding with, you know, the activities of illegal miners just because they want the benefit of it, the royalties of it. They come to give it to them and they are okay with it. They don't care about the consequences that are existing. But then, as I mentioned, there are also communities that you could see that, you know, the community leaders, traditional leaders, and also the local assembly are mindful of their actions against this. This boils down to the government drive in terms of, you know, formalizing, working hard to register and formalize the sector for a lot of people to engage in safe mining procedure. And I think that if this agenda is well pursued or widely pursued, then we may gradually solve this problem.
Okay. I really wish we had a lot more time to dig into this, but I think the key thing to note is hopefully that all the possible solutions that we've discussed will be listened to, adhered to, and that the government will jump on it. African governments will jump on it and be more serious about tackling illegal mining. Thank you very much for all those insights. Solomon Kusiamfofo, natural resources governance expert with knowledge in small-scale mining. Also, DW correspondent in Tamale, northern Ghana, Maxwell Souk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Across Ghana's mining regions, the cost of illegal mining is written on the land itself. Rivers turned brown, flattened forests, and farmlands poisoned by mercury and cyanide. Let's hear from some youth in Ghana sharing their thoughts on the situation.
There are a lot of bottlenecks in terms of acquiring mining licenses or small-scale mining licenses. The process is so tedious. And when you even follow the process and have a license, how to renew it back will be a problem. We have some of our elder brothers in the Talensi district who have legal licenses, but currently their licenses are expired and they have gone to all the appropriate authorities, agents, ministry to renew it. And they don't want to renew it for them. Secondly, they have taken the land that our brothers were doing small on it for the Chinese people. And the Chinese people don't even employ people from the Talensi. They employ people from the south. We can't sit idle. We have family. We have mothers. We have kids to pay their school fees. So in that case, we also have to go somewhere and dig small. So if the government will reduce the cost of the licenses and also reduce the bureaucracy, the process, so that any other person can walk to the office, acquire a mining license, will not pay much. There is so much unemployment in the constituency, in the district, and in the community as well too. So we can also sit in the house and fold our hands, also be depending on our parents as graduates and as school leavers. So we decided to talk to the appropriate people so that we also do small and get something to feed our family. So that's why we are here.
The reason we are engaging in these activities are because there are nowhere. Mostly when you travel, so majority of my friends, they've traveled. Yeah, but because I don't want to also travel and go and be suffering in someone's community, and I can find gold here. So that's why some of us, we are here trying to see if we can find something to at least better our lives.
Communities that once thrived on agriculture now depend on unstable mining work. Rights groups say women and children bear the brunt, facing displacement, unsafe conditions, and exploitation. The real challenge remains how to balance livelihoods, security, and sustainability in a sector that contributes so much to the economy, yet threatens its very foundation. What do you think? Share your thoughts with us on Facebook at DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe to our DW Africa YouTube channel so you never miss an episode. This show was co-produced and edited by Josie Mahachi. And I am Eddie Micah Jr. Thanks for listening.
DW News.
Here are today's top stories and why they matter. We begin in Cameroon, where President Paul Biya has secured another seven-year term, according to the country's Constitutional Council, further extending his decades-long rule amid political tension and disputed results. Opposition candidate Issa Chiroma claims he is the rightful winner. For the latest developments, here's our correspondent Moki Edwin Kinzeka.
President Paul Biya has been declared the winner of Cameroon's October 12 presidential election with just over 53% of the vote. At age 92, he begins a new seven-year mandate, extending his 43 years in power. Movements in the capital, Yaounde, remain restricted as security forces guard key areas following the announcement of results this afternoon.
Actually, I was surprised to hear the Constitutional Council proclaim Mr. Biya with a victory of 53%. Meanwhile, the whole country has been protesting, saying that it's Chiroma that took the victory, the whole country, the youth. So I don't know what a 92-year-old man will be able to lead the country tomorrow in future. I only pray there should be the peace that Cameroon was enjoying should come back.
I'm not surprised that President Paul Biya has won the presidential elections again. He controls the Constitutional Council. He controls the election body that controls elections in Cameroon. And the only thing we pray for is that there should be peace.
Issa Chiroma, who was announced second with 35%, maintains he won the vote. His supporters clashed with security forces in Douala, Garoua, and other towns on Sunday, with authorities saying four civilians were killed and dozens arrested. The opposition disputes these figures and accuse the military of using live ammunition during unrest.
In Cote d'Ivoire, vote counting is underway following Saturday's presidential election. Incumbent President Alassane Ouattara, now 83, is widely expected to secure a fourth term. Early results show him leading by large margins, often above 90% in several northern regions. The vote took place amid controversy. Key opposition figures, including former President Laurent Gbagbo and ex-banker Tijani Thiam, were barred from running. That left Ouattara facing four lesser-known challengers. While polling was calm in most areas, participation was high in pro-government strongholds, but low in parts of the south and west, where opposition calls for a boycott had an impact. The Electoral Commission is expected to announce full results by Monday. Why does this story matter? If confirmed, a fourth term for President Alassane Ouattara will break with tradition in one of West Africa's fastest growing economies. Critics warn it could entrench executive power at the expense of democratic norms, with youth unemployment still high and many rural communities feeling left behind. The credibility of this election could shape Cote d'Ivoire's future as a democratic outlier in the region. As we wrap up, in a major drug bust, Kenyan authorities seized over a ton of crystal methamphetamine valued at about $63 million aboard a stateless vessel roughly 630 kilometers off the coast of Mombasa. Six Iranian nationals were apprehended, and preliminary testing confirmed the shipment's authenticity, marking one of East Africa's largest narcotics seizures. Interior Minister Kipchumba Murkomen says authorities will publicly ban the narcotics that were seized. And that wraps up today's top stories. For insightful updates on how these events shape Africa and beyond, be sure to subscribe, like, and share your views below. And I'm Andrew Wasike.
for mine.